everybody. Welcome to Hit Rewind. I'm Michael. That's Kurzy on the other side.
How's it going?
All right, so I feel like we've discussed this over the years, like here and there, just lightly. Like, maybe one day down the road we'll do this. But I never thought we actually cemented down, like, hey, let's do Masters of Horror. Do you think it's because of how difficult it would be to choose? Like, we can't do all of them. It'd be like 8 episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to do, like, a series retrospective, I think, would be better. But I think picking just the best of the best is gonna be the best for this.
Yeah.
Because now a lot of people are going to be interested in watching. How much is it? Like 24 complete hours?
Yeah, and season two is weaker. And well, that also depends on if you're counting Fear itself, which is essentially season three. It's just under a different network, so they had to change the name.
Yeah, that one's not that good either.
Because they really trim the budget, and it's very PG-13. I mean, it's for NBC, so I don't really count it, but some people do.
Yeah, and season two was already dipping in quality a little bit.
Yeah. Desert Road, or what was it called? A Mountain Road. That one I only going to mention real quickly is it was written by Steven Romano, who 15 years ago, before the show ever aired, he did the artwork for Trash Cinema.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which one was that? Was that the pilot episode?
Yeah, that was the very first. Well, it's weird. I don't think it's actually the first episode. What it listed as and what I saw it as, I didn't see it on Showtime. I saw it when it hit video. So I feel like I got them out of order. That was the first one for me. I just want to mention that because any of the people who have been listening for a while know that Trash Cinema was one of the early shows, and that was the artwork that he did for it. All right. So, no particular order. I had you choose. There's only one that I cannot get through. I'm sorry, I can't, and we'll discuss that.
yeah, and it just so happens to be my favorite, so it's going to be a conversation, I'm sure.
The Stuart Gordon is such a wonderful weirdo, and may he rest in peace. It's actually kind of sad a few of these guys are gone, but Stuart Gordon, of course, most people know from Reanimator, but he did From Beyond, Fortress, Space Truckers, which is a really fucking strange sci-fi comedy adventure with Dennis Hopper.
And weirdly enough, I actually really liked Dagon as well.
I have not seen that one, and I was reading that the guy who stars in that is the star of the Witch episode.
Yes.
I really like the fact that he keeps touching back to Miskatonic University is where it's the made-up universe or college that's in Reanimator, like the Herbert West original story, and it just kind of keeps popping up here and there.
Yeah, he always returns to the well of H.P. Lovecraft, and good on him because he really gets it. I mean, Dagon is one of his last movies. It is shot on what looks to be about a $12 budget, but there is something about it that is just so infectious about his movies that, like, even years after he's gone, people are still making movies dedicated to him. Like, Suitable Flesh just came out a little while ago.
Yeah, it's...
And that was basically, like, all of his friends coming together to make, like, one last movie in his honor. And it was also really good.
Brian Yuzna is the guy who was helping produce along the way, and both of them just have this strong love. So if it's not Stuart Gordon attached to it, you'll find Yuzna's name absolutely on there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's one of those really tightly self-contained... I mean, most of these are small in scope because of the budget. But I really thought it was very claustrophobic and this otherworldly, disturbing feel the whole time. And I feel like there's another movie I saw called Fever. Alex Winter directed, and it's like 20 something years ago, where it's very similar to this, where it's just a guy trapped in his little apartment, but instead of it being a witch, he truly is himself just going insane.
It's interesting because the hallmarks of like cheap filmmaking for a lot of people is usually like tight enclosed spaces or wide open empty spaces, and very few directors are able to like take full advantage of that in the way that Stuart Gordon can. It is such a cheap little set, and somehow it feels like a large budget production.
I am never, ever, ever getting the rat with a human face out of my head.
That was, yeah, okay, so that was the thing that I was like, okay, people are gonna think this is stupid or gonna be terrifying. For me, terrifying.
Yeah. And it's all about, like, over the years in this place, this witch has sacrificed babies. And it's just funny. I really like the fact that, spoilers, the fact that he was proven innocent. It was just too late by the time they were, you know, they couldn't clear his name before the rat chewed his throat out.
Yeah, so basically the premise of this episode is a kid from college is going to live in a really cheap, dirtbag, slumlord apartment so he can get through school, and realizes slowly over time that the place that he's staying at is not necessarily haunted, but under some kind of demonic control of a witch that's like beyond the human realm. Mm-hmm. And is kind of like controlling people, and so it's him trying to pull this apart. And of course, you know, he's a college student, he doesn't think that any of this stuff is real, so you're kind of watching him slowly come to realize what's happening. But by the time he realizes, of course, it's too late, as is normal with an H.P. Lovecraft kind of story.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of his stories do end pretty tragic. Like, too fucking late, this ancient horror. It's always ancient, too. It's never, like, some hip or something cool and sexy. Well, there's nudity in this, but it's still truly disturbing.
Yeah. Another thing, too, is, like, I hate to spoil this, but I think it goes without saying that in a lot of movies, especially horror films, if there is a baby present, you're always going to be secured that, like, everyone can die but the baby. This goes the complete opposite. Pretty much everyone lives except the baby.
Yeah.
It's such a messed up scene that I was not expecting. And that's actually what I really liked about Masters of Horror. It kind of, every episode kind of tries to go out of its way to be like, to be unlike any other horror movie. Like, you start watching it like, oh, I've seen this a thousand times, but they always try to subvert.
Yeah, well, it wasn't trying to get box office. That's the thing that changed everything, is that they were free.
Exactly.
They said, you got this budget, there's only a couple rules, and pretty much go wherever you want. And I bet you a lot of these stories were ones that they were, like, contemplating, like, over the years, can I turn this into a movie? Maybe there was not enough substance, or no studio would greenlight it. These are awfully close. You could, if you wanted to, you could pad these to make them a movie, because they are, like, 60 minutes long.
Yeah, it reminded me of the first ABCs of Death movie, where it was kind of this very experimental, just give a ton of people, a ton of like burgeoning directors, a small budget, and be like, hey, just do anything you want, and then we'll make a movie out of these short films.
Yeah.
Not all, like most of them were terrible, but some of them were like really cool and creative, and that's kind of how I feel about the first season. Although there is a lot better quality control over in Masters of Horror, because you have a lot more established directors.
Yeah, I was thinking of, and I've never seen it, but there's a movie from 1990 with Dario Argento and George Romero called Two Evil Eyes, where they just took two stories that just, there wasn't enough, you know, story to pad it out to a full film, so they both did like 40-minute episodes and just put them together. You could do something like the Grindhouse did it.
Yeah. I mean, how did that turn out? Did you see it?
What, Two Evil Eyes?
Yeah.
No, I have not yet, but we should wrap around, like, there's some George Romero stuff, and we've never tapped on Dario Argento besides, you know, this next one. Did you like my segue? Ha ha!
That was a good one, yeah, I like
that. Dario Argento's Jennifer, based on a comic book, I believe it was an issue of Creepy, written by Bruce Jones and drawn by Bernie Wrightson, and I just coincidentally was listening to the Steven Weber episode of the Dana Gould Hour, where he talks about how he was so obsessed with this story as a kid, and when he had known Mick Garris because he had done The Shining and Desolation Row and a couple other things, and he said, I want to write this. And it's funny is that a lot of people only know Steven Weber from the TV show Wings, where he's the wacky brother, but there's another group of people who know him from more horror and sci-fi stuff.
I will say this about this episode. I really, whoever they got to do the music for this episode should have did it for every single episode, because this was, for me, it leaned really heavy on music.
Yeah,
and it's atmosphere, which is very appropriate for Argento. I've seen a few of his movies.
Yeah,
and it definitely feels like one of his movies.
It's Claudio Simonetti, who I believe was a member of Goblin, and both have done, I think, pretty much every Argento movie.
Mm-hmm. it definitely has that Argento style. Basically centers around this woman who has a very unfortunate deformity in her face that prevents her from like speaking or communicating in any way, and there's this man that's about to kill her, and a cop, you know, it intervenes and, you know, takes her to a place to be safe, but they're basically going to do some kind of electroshock therapy or just put her away for whoever, who knows how long, and he understandably feels bad for this person and tries to take her in, but then realizes, oh, she eats people. Like, she's like some kind of demoness, but like there's enough sympathy for her that you never feel that it's malicious. It's just like, this is just what she does. Like, this is normal to her. Yeah. She doesn't understand that it's wrong. So, like, you do understand why the character, or the main character, would feel bad and try to help her, even though it's this horrible situation.
Well, it's interesting watching his whole life collapse because of this girl he's trying to take care of. You know, he's a cop, and slowly he loses his job, he loses his family, he loses his home, and he has to go on the run, and he finds himself desperately just trying to get a job at a little quickie stop or something like that. And
he's looking like a complete meth addict too.
Yeah. Is he addicted to drugs, or he's addicted to her?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's kind of the metaphor they're going for.
Yeah, is she metaphysical? What is it? Why is he so locked in on her and he can't shake her?
I mean, it's part of it, his obsession. Like, he, from the beginning, he was very obsessed about this case that he was trying to solve. And so, like, her having this mystery about her that he's trying to unlock, he's trying to figure out, he's trying to help, and slowly, and over the course of time, realizing that he can't, and then at the end, you know, does the same thing that the guy in the beginning did, trying to kill her.
Yeah.
It's just a really unfortunate, really sad story where I don't feel like there's any villain.
Yeah,
though there's a person that eats people.
Right, right. Well, I mean, because she doesn't understand, and he's just a lost, broken soul who's trying to do the best he can. And
yeah, like, when he yells at her or, like, tries to explain that it's wrong, she feels genuine remorse. Yeah. She just doesn't understand it. I know that we've said that, like, several times, but it's just a really well-told story that is just really dour.
Most of these episodes have a serious side, but there's a couple episodes here and there that have a good sense of, like, macabre humor to them, and I think both of them are the John Landis episodes. I think maybe Dante did an episode that was funny, too. But Dear Woman feels like something he almost could bring to, you know, like, oh, In the Spirit of Innocent Blood and American Werewolf in London, another horror comedy from John Landis. Like, one of those he almost got to the movie stage, and then just said, okay, well, let's just trim this and turn it to an episode. I had a lot of fun with it.
This was the first one where, like, because there is some kind of a little bit of comedy in each episode, and it never really kind of hits its peak like this one does. This one was constantly entertaining.
Yeah,
knew exactly what it was and what it was trying to do, and it just hit every note properly. Like, even as stupid as, like, the main cop that we're following, he's on the weird cases, so you get a little bit of, like, the kind of stuff that he does day to day as the cop that does the weird stuff. Like, I love the creativity and just how unserious it all is.
Yeah, and he's such a likable guy. Most people don't know Brian Benben, except for he was in a Dolph Lundgren movie called I Come in Peace, which, if you're a cult movie lover, you know that one. And then the TV show Dream On for like 6 or 7 years. But other than that, he really is mostly a stage guy. He's pretty likable.
Yeah, I had a great time with this one. The basic premise is that there's a rash of murders that look to be some kind of like large animal. And a cop is going out of his way to try to find out what kind of animal it is, and why it's attacking specifically men. Coming to understand that it is some kind of folklore tale from Native Americans about a deer that's kind of like a woman from the waist up, disguises herself to lure and kill men. And what I really like about it, because they kind of bring up that in a lot of these old folklore tales, these creatures, they never really die. There's never really any, like, ending to these kind of mythological stories, it's just ones that always go on. So there's really nothing you can do, and so that's, there is a sense of kind of horror in that, even though this is a really funny episode.
Yeah.
But it's the idea that, like, there's nothing you can do. You just have to accept it.
It's kind of like Jeepers Creepers. You just, like, no matter what, you're not really going to stop. It may slow him down, but every 23 years, the dude's going to come back.
Yeah.
Or zombie movies, you know, it's just like you can't kill every single zombie. You, no matter, even if you're safe for now, you're never truly safe. It's a wave.
Yeah, and he does everything he can to kill this thing, and it just will not die.
Yeah, I love how he rationalizes. He's trying to break down the case in his head, so there's all these little fantasies about what happened. Like somebody who just pulls little hooves out of her purse.
Oh, I forgot about that. they show, like, the guy, the trucker, and they just do it in, like, three or four different ways this guy could have died.
Yeah.
And it just gets progressively more ridiculous. like some guy with a giant deer head or something.
Yeah. I like the part towards the end when his friend is gambling and he meets her, whatever. And it's a little far-fetched to believe that this girl just never says a word. Like, if it was me, I'd be like, do you say anything at all? Instead of just nodding. But, of course, he's drunk, so he's not completely with it. But when he has that when he has that rationalization in his hotel room and he knows he's fucked, I like that moment.
But yeah, that's the part that stands out to me, is that look of fear of, like, oh, I fucked up. She's right behind me, isn't she?
Yeah.
Going back to that, like, to me it does make sense, because she's basically targeting lonely men. And I think that's why they're willing to look past the fact that she doesn't say anything.
Maybe.
Like, truckers who go town to town, you know, they just need some companionship for the night before they head out. You know, drunk losers at a casino, you know. So for me, I bought it. It basically just picking out the weak from the herd, essentially. It's supposed to kind of evoke that nature, predatory animal vibe.
Yeah, there's another moment where, usually in these kind of movies, when there's some sort of mythological thing, they usually have a guy who's experienced in that world come in and explain how deadly serious it is. But this one kind of, like, kicks into the balls, and he's like, because they have a Native American guy come in, and he's like, are you talking about the deer woman? Oh, okay, that's, I know all about this. And he's like, it's all bullshit.
Yeah. He's just trying to, like, placate some gamblers for fun, and then realizing, oh, you guys are serious? This is stupid. Why
yeah. the next one is the Lucky McKee bug episode, which is a sweet, demented, weird little romance that's also truly disgusting.
Yeah, this is, for me, like, number two or three. This is a really fun romantic comedy with a I don't know, some kind of gross twist on it.
Yeah,
it's,
gooey.
It's just so
angle. Yeah.
Fun and so heartwarming at the same time. And the creature effects, they hold off on creature effects for the most majority of it. Like, it's a really crappy kind of looking bug.
Uh-huh.
But when the lady turns into the bug at the end, holy shit. It was like, okay, that's where the budget went.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's
so she's an, what is it, entomologist? What is the bug specialist called?
I don't know, bugologist.
Yeah, bugologist. So she's, like, obsessed with them, and she has them in her apartment. It's her whole life. And then she's kind of, like, looking at this girl who's been hanging around the lobby, and she's kind of, you know, wanting to say something to her, and they're both shy, and they get along well. Now, here's the part where I get confused. Somewhere along the way, she gets a package with this weird bug in it. And she kind of explains it at the end, but I wasn't sure I was piecing it all together. But her girlfriend gets bit by the bug, or an infester, and she basically becomes a giant bug, and they can have bug babies. They spread their species. Who sent the box, and who was it meant for?
Okay, so it was the gal in the lobby. It was her father sent it to the main character to try to kill her.
Why?
Because he is really anti-gay, and he doesn't like that his daughter is in love with the main character.
Okay.
It's not a great explanation, but you don't really need it. It's a really good story.
Okay, so I'm just guessing, because the package was sent before they really even knew each other. So I'm wondering if he knew about her crush. Whatever, it doesn't matter. But when she starts to snap and she rips that that fucking old lady is like, "You're gonna try to have sex with my little niece or whatever." And I was like, "That's not how this works. Why do you?"
Yeah, that's not how gay people work.
Man. Yeah, well, or it's like, oh, so if she was straight and you had a little nephew, would you still think the same thing? Probably not.
Right, exactly. It's yeah, a lot of it is just is about homophobia. So that's kind of that's sort of the, like the overarching kind of plot of what's happening.
Yeah.
These people are just trying to live their life and just kind of are always hitting obstacles from their parents, from judgmental landlords, because I'm not entirely sure at this moment in time if gay people were protected from being evicted by landlords, if they were a protected class of citizen. I'm not sure. I'd have to look back. This was 2004, I think.
6 and 7, I believe, or 7 and 8. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what the commentary was trying to make.
But she's fucking hilarious. When she starts to snap God. And she's turned, I couldn't stop, like, rooting for her, even though I know she's a monster.
Yeah, that's also another thing that I love about Masters of Horror. You usually end up rooting for the monster, and that's always fun.
Too. Yeah.
another thing about it, I just had a whole thing. I just totally forgot.
It's okay. I don't know if you take notes. Some of the people I do the show with, they have like these notes, and I'm like, what are you doing? I know it's more organized, but it doesn't feel natural.
Yeah.
If you remember as you go along.
Better than just being like, oh, I don't know, I'm going to say something, but I forgot.
Yeah. The next episode is Cigarette Burns, which I absolutely, that's the only one I was like, we got to have that one, and you were like already on board.
Yeah, that was the first one I purchased. I purchased a few of the movies, but that was the one that I was like, yes, this is what I wanted.
I can't remember. Is it one episode per disc or is it two per disc?
It's one.
Really? Well, they really got their money's worth. I think I ended up picking up both seasons for like $4.99. So Cigarette Burns is the only thing I think that has truly, truly traumatized my sister, who I watched this series with. Like, she still talks about it today and, like, shudders.
Yeah. So, in watching this one, like, this was number 6 or 7 in the season order.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised this wasn't the first.
Sorry, what?
I'm surprised this wasn't the first. This is the only one I ever hear anybody talk about. Like, knock your fucking socks off.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why people still talk about it. But what stood out to me was how effectively John Carpenter is able to utilize his budget. It is, like, a full-on movie that you're watching.
Yeah, this is the only one where I forgot. And nothing about it feels like a TV show.
It looks better than Children of the Damned. That one looks like a TV movie. This looks like a movie.
It's so funny because everybody says, "Oh, he didn't direct a movie between Ghost of Mars and whatever that ghost, The Ward." But I honestly got to tell you, these just because they're shorter doesn't mean it's a movie. It's a movie to me. This, and then he did Pro Life in the second season, which I don't remember being anywhere nearly as good, even though it's the same team, the writers and the director.
It's pretty good. I didn't put it in because like we're already talking about one Carpenter movie. We don't need another. Like,
yeah.
This one is top tier.
The Cigarette Burns, it builds this mythology around a lost film. And I really can understand, like, people have this obsessiveness with any sort of lost art, lost media. Like, we're only 2 months away, I believe, from viewings of The Day the Clown Cried or something like that, the Jerry Lewis Holocaust movie.
Oh, my God.
That has been lost. Yeah.
I was at in Las Vegas. I was at Zach Bagan's stupid haunted house bullshit, but he had a clip of that movie, and playing at on a projector in his like celebrity room or whatever.
Yeah.
They were talking about how it's going to be released any day now, and I was like, how about not? Like, he explained the premise, and I'm like, yeah, let's just burn it. Like, why do we want it?
I don't know. There's something about it being denied. Art of any kind, no matter how terrible or even dangerous it can be, is like a drug. I gotta have it. And then most of the time when you get it, you're like, oh, well, I built that up for nothing.
Yeah.
Shit.
A lot mass media is a huge, especially online, is a thing that people really obsess over, of like trying to track down missing things.
What's that black voodoo god video? It was a VHS tape that was worth like $4,000 because they only made like 15 of them. And it was like black voodoo god or something like that. It's a little puppet. And then when people saw it, I was like, oh, this is a giant piece of shit.
Yeah, it's kind of a waste.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're really into like preservation, then I understand getting excited about stuff, even if it's bad. But like, if you're trying to track it down because you want entertainment, you're probably going to be disappointed by the vast majority of lost media.
Now, if you've ever seen
it, lost for a reason.
Yeah, The Ninth Gate with Johnny Depp kind of taps into a little bit of this too. These lost books that can tap into something dangerous.
Or 8mm.
Yeah, that genre of the taboo thing you should not be looking for. What I like about it is that, surprise, you know, Norman Reedus, I forget how good he is because I stopped watching The Walking Dead a really long time ago. This taps into something in him. Like, there's a sweet sadness, even though he's driven. They could have played him as a fucking cynical badass. That's not how they want to do it.
Yeah, that's something that's so interesting about Norman Reedus that I think a lot of people are starting to realize, of like his star power, is that he can both be a really emotionally vulnerable badass, and that is very rare and not really something that was desired at that time period, but I think a lot of people are kind of turning around on that.
Yeah. And famed Euro trash actor Udo Kier is in this, and he hires him. He's like this guy who's tapped into everything he can with his resources. Nothing where he can't reach it. Everything is within his grasp. I was trying to say the opposite within that. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
He hears about this film and he's like, you're a guy, you're a searcher, you can find this stuff. I'll pay you top dollar, find me this film. And just this hellish road that he goes down. Sweet Jesus, those fucking crazy snuff film guys. That's probably the most, I know there's some really disgusting stuff at the end, but that's the part that fucked me up the most.
Yeah, just like the cruelty of that scene.
Just hacking away, as if it was a fucking piece of, you know, like you're a butcher and it's a cow.
Yeah, exactly. What I really enjoy about the structure is that at the beginning they talk about like how amazing this film is, and to behold it is like this holy grail that people are looking for. And then Udo Kier's opens the door to their room, and there's like this desiccated guy just standing on this pillar being rotated, because he was like one of the actors in the movie. And like crossing that threshold, your brain goes, wait, is that just an actor like painted up like in the movie, or is that an angel? Like, you're trying to figure out, like, is he messing with him, or have people gone crazy, or is this real? And that's kind of the question that kind of is plagued throughout the movie, about like the power of the film is just the idea of the obsession of thinking about it causes people to go insane.
Yeah, it's just wild. Like, it's there, he could, it's so funny how Carpenter handles this, unlike a lot of the movies he handles, because even like, okay, everybody praises Prince of Darkness now, but I still think, and I know it's, you're gonna be mad at me, but I still think it's a very clumsy movie. Like, only the one thing works, and that's the video, you know, watching the video of the guy, the Satan in the hallway,
that,
or whatever.
That is the best part.
Yeah, and the whole movie feels like that segment. Like, I feel like I'm not supposed to be watching this episode.
Yeah, exceptional work from beginning to end. Norman Reedus is, this period of time, is really trying to find himself as an actor. I feel like he fumbles kind of a lot, but there's still kind of this charm and charisma about him that he's like really trying and he's going for it.
And I think
It's a little clumsy, but it is very forgivable for this kind of movie.
And I think it's Udo Kier's best performance. He's not, I mean, I never saw some of his early stuff, like the Andy Warhol stuff, but most of the stuff I see is campy on purpose. And his performance, when he's, you don't know exactly what's going on when you find out later that he's shoving his intestines into a projector.
Yeah.
And he's still trying to have this calm conversation, even though he's going clearly like insane. And I was like, wow, it's fucking impressive, because I usually know him for being trashy. By the way, I used to have a coworker whose name was Garrett, but I used to say it like Udo Kier all the time. Hello, Garrett. And it would make him laugh and make him uncomfortable at the same time. And I just fucking love it. Why, hello, Garrett.
Yeah, this is probably the best that this whole series has to offer. There's a lot of really great ones, but I do think this probably stands out as the best.
Now, the next one is the one that was just too hard for me. I tried twice. I tried when it came out, and I tried, last week, and then I went, okay, there's only a half hour to go. I can do this. I can fucking do this. I don't like Takashi Miike's films. We watched one, 4 or 5 years ago that really, I had to try over and over. I had to watch in chunks because it's so goddamn brutal. I can't remember the name.
Probably Ichi the Killer.
Yeah, that was it. That's it. Fucking hell, man. I mean, I'm impressed that he can go that far, but it ain't for me. It is not for me.
Mm-hmm. So I'll take over on this one.
Yep.
Did you actually watch it all the way through?
No, I couldn't do it anymore. Once they were torturing that girl, I had to tap out.
Oh my god, yeah, okay. So basically the plot is that a man from America has lost his bride. He used to live in Japan. He had to move back home, and then he's going to come back and take her to America. He had to take care of something first, but he never explains what it is. He goes on the search and finds that there is a brothel that he believes that she was sold as a sex slave for. He ends up spending a night with one of the geishas who is deformed and tries to get talks to her about what happened. And it is just a story about the complete misery that is what it's like being a woman in Japan at a time period. This is a period film. And it is, for me, incredibly engaging. I know that you disagree, but for me, I was captivated, and this was the only movie that legitimately gave me the creeps.
Well, I didn't tap out because it was boring or wasn't engaging.
Oh, okay.
I can't watch the torture. I just couldn't do it.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
It was too much for me.
There is a scene. There's this very quick little thing that got me so hard because I was watching it late at night. It was midnight. I was alone. the only thing that was lit up in my whole house was this movie, and I'm watching it. And there's a scene where, very early on, where the geisha cries out in fear. And I was like, oh, I was taken aback for a second. And then the guy turns around, there's nothing there. I was like, oh, okay. Well, so she has demons in her head or something. And then the guy is talking to her, and then something moves in the background. And I was like, hold, and it just happens for a split second. I was like, oh, I missed it. I wasn't paying attention. So I went back, and it was this floating face, a woman's eyes gouged out, stuff just pouring down her face. For a brief second, I legitimately, in terror, almost threw my iPad.
Oh, my God. I remember that part. Yeah, yeah. I think. Go ahead. Let me know when you're done. I'll take over on Neighbors.
Oh, okay. So, this one does something that I really enjoy that's really hard to pull off, and this one did it masterfully. So it is the idea of telling a story start to finish, and then halfway through you start over again, but you give more context. So the first half of the movie plays out as the geisha is explaining her life, what led her up to this moment, and how she knows his wife, right? And the story is heavily edited to please him because she is a prostitute, so she is selectively editing bits about her life to give herself more agency, to make her feel more empowered, so he, as a patron, would feel better about sleeping with her. It's like, oh, so this is kind of, you do this by choice, so I don't have to feel bad about this. And then at the halfway point she says, look, your wife's dead, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do about it. And then he freaks out and panics and then demands to know the whole story. And that's when she goes back from the beginning, kind of taunting him for this is a fantasy, isn't this what you want? I don't understand. And then okay, you want the whole story, here's the whole story. Then goes back and gives more context for all of those moments where you think she has agency, she doesn't. She's always being told what to do, being forced into sex slavery, even as a child. And it's just horrible, awful. But the key thing that happens is that his wife was sold into slavery by her parents, and he's too late. She steals some kind of ring from the madam of the geisha house, and just has her tortured to death because she wants the ring back. And they show it, and it is so horrifying. Did you get to the part where she has a hand in her head?
A hand in her head?
Yes.
No, I don't even understand what that means.
Okay, so this part is really silly, and I kind of hate that they did this at the end. But, so, like, throughout the movie, she's, like, having visions, or she's, like, talking to herself, or, like, hitting her head. And you think that, like, maybe she's mentally ill. But it's actually, she has, like, a sister, like, that was born in her head.
Oh.
And it's, like, manifests as a human hand. So it's, like, behind her hair, and it just, like, moves, and now there's, like, a hand sticking out of her head with, like, eyes and teeth.
Oh.
It's very goofy looking. It's very silly, and I hate that they did that at the end. But anyway, the ultimate, the ending of the story is that the man kills the geisha, and he's imprisoned, and we're kind of looking back on him as a character, because he's very passive in this story, but realizing that, like, he is actually not a good person either. Like, he intentionally left her behind, and this is a situation that he brought on upon her.
So
it has a really good twist at the end. It's a really well told story. It is incredibly brutal, though.
Yes.
So anyway, that was Takashi Miike, who I absolutely love as a writer, director, everything. So yeah, I didn't have a good time, but it was a really good story.
What I did have a good time at, and I'm pretty sure you did, is John Landis is back with Neighbors. And holy crap, what a hoot. George Wendt is mostly known for sitcoms, mostly Cheers. But he started off as
this episode is a sitcom, let's be honest.
It is, but he started off as a David Mamet guy. He was on the Chicago, you know, their version of Broadway, doing dead serious plays for years. And he gets to tap a little bit into that. I wish he got to do it more. But this is like the perfect combination of, oh, that's fucking twisted, and that's pretty fucking funny.
So I remember I was saying that, like, I didn't want to put two of the same director from season one and two. I had to give it up to John Landis. This was a standout for season two.
Well, Pro-Life isn't anywhere nearly as good as Cigarette Burns. I actually think it's just mid for me. I was disappointed when I saw it. But Neighbors...
Yeah, I agree.
I think Neighbors is the best episodes of season two. I know it's not saying much. Shut up.
This is, to give it the best compliment you can, this feels like season one.
Yeah. What is the plot synopsis of this one?
Okay. Plot synopsis is that there are two new people coming in to move into this neighborhood where there is a man who is basically a serial killer living next door to them, and it is them slowly getting involved into his life and what that means. And spoilers, they're there to kill him because he killed a family member of theirs.
He's trying to create the perfect family, and he's finding all these random people to kill and strip them of their flesh with, what, lye or something like that? And recreate.
Yeah, that's another thing I really liked about this episode, is that there's a lot of horror movies where there's like pure white skeletons in house. Like, that's not how it would happen, but they actually show the process of him bleaching the bones and everything. So, like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. And I love the conversations, the arguments he has with people who are not there, or the imagined sexual conversations he has with the neighbor girl.
Yeah, it is a laugh riot. I love this episode. What I think is really interesting about the serial killer as a character is that he's very aware that he's insane.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unique, because, like, if he was just insane, he would just introduce people to his dead family. But he knows that people would be scared.
Right,
people
right.
would tell on him. So he lies. Or he doesn't lie. He's like, I'm single, which is true on a literal sense, but in his imagined family life, he has a wife. So it's really interesting to see how he handles those conversations.
There's that scene where he uses a key to let her out the back door so that she could smoke. And at first, I thought she was a moron. Like, if you see anybody do something like that, you're in fucking trouble. Like, why am I locked in the house?
Yeah, but to get some context, he was basically like aggressively hitting on her. Uh-huh. I think at a dinner table where the husband wasn't there, and like their marriage was kind of getting a little bit rocky at this point, so he was basically trying to find an in, and was making her very uncomfortable. And yeah, if you were like me, I was like, yeah, why are you gonna stay at his house and have a cigarette? Just leave.
Well, it's interesting is the trick that the writer and the story plays on you is the fact that you assume that he's killed her husband. The whole time you're like, okay, so he's made him disappear, so he has this opportunity, when in fact he had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. That's the twist there. She goes out for the cigarette, and you think, okay, this is where he's going to kill her, and that's how this is going to end. No, plot twist, they know he's a serial killer because he killed their daughter. And she's intentionally staying there to give her husband time to sneak attack him, basically.
Yeah. It's a fun riot. The next one isn't that ridiculous either. I mean, sorry. I don't know why I was going. I hate it when I do this, when I derail. It's not as dead serious. It's kind of ridiculous. But in a fun way. I think it's called The Washingtonians is an episode. The one that Peter Medak directed. I think it's weird that Peter Medak is even considered a master of horror. I feel like you should have to do more than a couple films in order to get there. A lot of these guys, especially season 2, they're just like scratching the bottom of the barrels. Like, did he do a horror movie? Technically that counts. Okay, no it doesn't. Peter Medak did Species 2. I'm not counting that piece of shit as a master. And The Changeling, which apparently is really good. I've never seen it, though.
Yeah, you could tell that they couldn't get all of it. Like, they tried to get all of the same directors back for season 2, but
yeah,
clearly some of them were busy. Takashi Miike did not make a return. They did get a different Japanese director who didn't do a good job.
I was bummed by both of Toby Hooper's episodes. I know he's had a hit-and-miss kind of career, but he always has kind of his own style and attitude. But man, I gotta tell you, after, like, Spontaneous Combustion, it's all downhill.
Yeah, okay, so he did direct the episode in season 1 that is basically just a Romeo and Juliet tale.
Yeah,
like some sort of... I get what he's going for. He just didn't have the budget to enact his vision, because it's supposed to be like a post-apocalyptic future, and it just looks like any road in small-town America. Like, it does not look like a desolate place. It's very strange. Like, you forget that it's supposed to be the future.
Yeah. The Washingtonians is this family is going to their grandmother's house because she has just passed away, and there's something secret in the building, but also, like, there's crazy fucking people who want to eat the children, and this is wild. They're all looking at her like, she's so delicious, I can take a bite out of her cheek, and you're just like,
I could just eat her up.
Boy, they really do tap in, because as a child, I was very afraid of adults. They're all like, you're so cute, pinch his cheek. I'm like, I don't know, I hid behind my mother's leg most of my first 8 or 9 years because I just didn't trust adults. I get where this kid's coming from.
I definitely relate to that anxiety around people.
Yeah, there's something just disturbing, but he really taps into that. Her viewpoint of what's going on. She knows something's weird, but the parents aren't just, like, you know, locked in yet.
Yeah, I didn't pick this episode because I thought it was a standout or particularly great. I probably would have picked another season 1 episode. There was actually one that I really was debating on, which is the one where it's, like, two dueling serial killers.
Oh, Pick Me Up. Yeah, that was a really good one.
That one is so good, but I had to pick this one because I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the time period in which this show was taking place. So this is, you know, after the Iraq War, obviously, and there is, like, Toby Hooper's... No, it wasn't Toby Hooper's, was it? No.
Are you talking about Homecoming, the Joe Dante episode?
Joe Dante, that was it, yeah. Yeah, the one for season 1 where Joe Dante's tale about soldiers coming back from the dead to vote. And that episode is very much of its time, and so is this one, where it's like, this is after the lies have been found out about the Iraq War, and there was a complete pendulum swing of people who are now against it.
Yeah.
And this one is really about the anxieties about Americans sort of, like, reevaluating what it means to be an American, or, like, even, like, what America is founded on. And so it's kind of, like, a little bit about that conversation. Of course, taking it to the extreme of, like, oh, they were the Founding Fathers were cannibals.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's silly. But I get what you're saying. And One thing that I think is interesting is that there is this, I also wanted to talk about this one because I wanted to promote a horror series on YouTube that you can watch called The Monument Mythos.
Okay.
Because it takes a very similar idea about America, like for the Monument Mythos, it's that there's like these secret creatures that are hidden inside of American monuments that are devouring people, and it sort of takes like the history of America and kind of like plays with it a little bit, and it does that really well. This one does not pull it off very well. It's very silly, over the top, and doesn't really make any sense, but given its time period and what it's trying to say, like it's definitely trying to be a part of this conversation. And so I think for that, looking back on it, it's kind of interesting.
I think it's funny, is kind of connected to this, is where people can't deal with changes in history. Like, I still know people who can't deal with the fact that Christopher Columbus was a fucked up asshole who he didn't really discover America, and they're like, he was a great Italian American. This is what someone said to me last year, and I was like,
Italian American, come on.
He was a great explorer, you know, that kind of stuff where people can't deal with true history. They'd rather, rely on the mythos, the fantastical, than reality of it. And that kind of taps into it, too. It's like, well, you got this crazy fantasy. We're going to go even crazier with this fantasy, you know?
Yeah, even in weirdly small details, like people think that George Washington had wooden teeth. No, it was sheep teeth. I don't know why we believe that it's that, but
yeah.
It's an interesting thing where, like, the more you learn about history, in any history, I'm not saying, like, oh, America's bad or anything, but it is. But, like, every culture has its own, like, uncomfortable history that
You say that, but knowing that, like, all every single country has some sort of fucked up history, and current stuff to fix, yeah. I want to bring up...
And so, this is the, like, I think the turning point in American culture, because, you know, it had, like, the Reagan years, like, oh, yay, pro-America, all the way up to... Like, oh, we gotta, you're either with us or against us.
Right. Remember that whole, like, oh.
Now this is like, yeah.
You're not back in the Iraq war or whatever, you Frenchies. We're changing it to freedom fries. You know, that kind of sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's an interesting reevaluation of American history. Like, wait, are we the bad guys here?
I think it's
interesting.
David Cross has a really funny bit where he'll be like, oh, don't you dare comment on America being negative. And people will be like, yeah, you know what? America's under, you know, civil war, man. They're tearing us apart, and, you know, I don't know what to do about it. But like, oh, yeah, there are a lot of problems in this country. Why don't you get out of it then? Love or leave it! Yeah. That kind of bullshit behavior. Stuart Gordon did another episode of Masters of Horror. You didn't say it, so I didn't bring it up, but The Black Cat has been done a few times, and that movie I was telling you about, the one that Romero and Argento did together, I think it was actually Romero and Fulci, I can't remember, but it's called The Black Cat, and they did their own version of that, so I'm curious to see what it's like.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet, the Masters of Horror one?
No, I can't remember it, but if you were going to bring it up, I was like, oh, well, there are other versions of this we could watch. No, sorry.
It was okay.
Yeah. 81 is the Fulci, Argento and Romero is 1990, The Black Cat, and something else.
Yeah, what I could really tell about the Black Cat episode is that... Who made it again?
Who wrote it originally? Right? Was Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the Masters of Horror, that was Gordon, right?
Yeah, Stuart Gordon.
Yeah, I could tell whoever, like, made that was... really loved Edgar Allan Poe. They incorporated like all of his like really well-known stories into one that's a meta-narrative about himself. It's really well written.
Yeah.
It just didn't hold, and also showing Edgar Allan Poe not as like this weepy little goth kid, but like as an asshole. Like, he has such an interesting life that I think a lot of people don't know about. And so like seeing that was really interesting, but it kind of lost me at the midpoint.
Yeah, it's funny, Edgar Allan Poe, before we go, I was listening to an audiobook on action stars of the 80s, and how Stallone was obsessed with playing Edgar Allan Poe since even before Rocky. And I'm just trying to wrap my head around him as Edgar Allan Poe. And then Michael Jackson wanted to play Edgar Allan Poe, and I'm just like, guys, that's just so weird. Jeffrey Combs, that's it. That's your only Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah. Yeah, a weird little nerd who's an alcoholic, abusive piece of shit. Yeah, yeah. That's perfect for Combs.
He's not cool and sexy like fucking John Cusack and the Raven. Stop that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so that is it. I know we probably didn't pick all the episodes you would. Why don't you do your own episode and let us know what you would like to add to your like top 8, top 10, whatever it is. But yeah, we had to kind of call it a little bit.
Yeah, I would say that if you are interested in watching more, watch the entirety of season 1 and only watch the ones from season 2 that we mentioned.
Yeah.
There's a real lack of quality control in season 2.
Pick Me Up is pretty damn good. That's another one where I almost was like, yeah, you got to do that one too. But, you know, like, we're limited. So that is it, everybody. Thank you for listening. We'll be back whenever we are. I don't know how to end an episode ever. Never.
Let's say good night, folks.
All right. I could do that. Yeah. Fuck it.